everybody. You're about to hear Listener's Guide Season 3, coming to you from Big Secret Records headquarters in Portland, Oregon. This is the season I've been waiting for, we've all been waiting for, quite frankly. We're finally approaching the release of Bob Cummins Jr.'s second album, Good American Songbook. This is the album that inspired me to start Big Secret Records, because this thing could not just exist in the nether regions of streaming services. It had to be a real thing that you could play on a record player and hold in your hand and read the liner notes. I played on some of it and produced it with Bob between the Echo Lab in Denton, Texas, and my old studio in that same city that I called The Nest, and we mixed it together immediately after I settled in Portland and waited for the vinyl plants to start pressing again for the little guys such as ourselves, and now here we are. There's not much more of a story to tell, though. It's just a really good album. Great, even. And Bob wrote some really great songs. I'm really proud of the role I played on it, so I'm happy to present Bob and myself, plus Raymond Ruskies, who played drums on almost the entire thing, discussing the whole album this season, front to back. We got together in North Texas following the premiere of the indie horror film 13 Tracks Frightened Agatha Black, which, by the way, features all of us on the score that is now available on Bandcamp, by the way. We ate some cookies and solidified plans for our next project that was starting in just a few weeks at the time, Shakewell Live. So these episodes are a real moment in time for the Big Secret Records heads. There's also a few special appearances later on from Jasper Johnson, who played bass and guitar throughout the album. And we'll hear from Amari Amor, who has a feature on Side B and played some guitar on the closer to Side A. But we'll get to all that soon enough. Let's talk Good American Songbook, folks. Actually, before we kick off the season, I have to apologize for the audio when Raymond joins the discussion. We had him all mic'd up, but the audio wasn't recorded. I'm still scratching my head over it because we were able to monitor his mic as we recorded, and we all went straight into my multi-track field recorder. I don't know, but that's the way this cookie crumbled. It's not the end of the world, but I'm a little bummed about it. And after we recorded this, I was finding out that I was coming down with a brutal upper respiratory infection, and you can hear that settling in the longer we talk about these songs. So there's that too. Anyway, in this episode we're talking about the opener, But That's My Life, and we cover things like the shadow of Bob's debut, Shakewell, Neil Hamburger, New York City saxophones, guitar synthesizers, and the flutes that almost weren't. Listen. Do you remember if that was like an idea as old as Honolulu, or if that was a newer song that you were writing?
That was, I think, one of the first ones. I think it was written after all the Shakewell stuff, but I'm gonna guess like July or August 2020. I wrote that one. I just wrote that progression, and the lyrics, at the very least, the first lyric, But That's My Life, is I was listening to a lot of Neil Hamburger at the time, and that is his catchphrase. So that's where that comes from.
Oh, I didn't know that. All right. Yeah. I didn't make that connection.
Mm-hmm. But that's my life. But it's got such like a pathetic appeal to it, I think. Like, I think his act is funny, obviously, but there was a lot of things going wrong for me at the time, and I was like, okay, but that's my life.
But that's, you know, my life, yeah.
It's kind of a sad sack, silly thing going on.
I was thinking when I was listening to it yesterday that there is like a touch of humor in all of your songs, but it's not like an annoying, like, Frank Zappa way or something.
Sure, sure.
Like, it just... I don't know how to explain it, but it's just enough. So it's funny to hear a line that I thought was really kind of sad,
right,
coming from that place.
Right. I don't necessarily go in trying to write funny lyrics, but sometimes it happens, I guess.
Well, I mean, musically too, there's just moments where there's like a lightheartedness to it. Maybe that's a better...
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I generally like writing things that are satisfying, and a lot of a lot of the time that's something that is funny. You know, they happen to coincide. Not even funny, just like surprising.
Yeah, there's a lot of musical humor that I found in like Shakewell. I remember texting you a lot and being like, this one sound is really funny, but like, you know, in the song it's not like it's trying to be like a novelty thing or anything. It's just like this one thing like really struck me, and I think it's totally like surprise. And that's what I thought of in But That's My Life with your demo of the what became the guitar solo.
Oh right, the like
that sound.
Right. What the inspiration was behind that original solo. I think I was trying to emulate like Wings or something like that, like very 70s.
Andy's favorite.
Yeah, Andy, your favorite band, Wings.
My favorite man.
But or like Floyd. I know you love them too.
was it always like just that verse and then music?
Yeah, no, I don't think there was ever a second verse to it. I think I wanted to write a second verse, but it's that thing where you write half a song and you're like, I'll come back to it. Or you listen to the demo over and over again and you're like, I don't want to write just like half-ass lyrics to the rest of this.
Yeah. Did you always have... I forget the genesis of the sax part.
Well, we were first planning to just do a guitar solo and then possibly a synth solo, I think, in the if I remember correctly, in the actual recorded version. But, I mean, why not do a sax solo?
Yeah,
it just sounds like it could work.
That big piano part, it felt very like New York to me.
Right. Like when Rodney was recording it, you always kept saying like he's under a street lamp or something. I have Bleeding Gums Murphy.
Yeah, it looked to me like this 80s kind of view of like Manhattan. Like you're right. In a hotel and you're looking down on the city and you're like sad.
Exactly.
Chris Clemens walks out and
right.
And I think it's a cool texture against that guitar too, where it's like this fucked up guitar and then like a real smooth like natural sound
that becomes fucked up over time.
Yeah even that, like he manages to take that into a new place,
right? Because it's kind of a stressful progression.
Yeah.
But it also, like, the progression reminds me of like Steely Dan too, and that music is very like glitzy in a really sad way.
Yeah,
the like a sax solo fits that, I think.
Yeah, like a down and out way, which is very much the vocal. I think it's you're kind of wallowing in down and outness, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
But I appreciate that it's a brief vocal. You're not like really complaining. It's like a thought that you have, you know, like you're sort of acknowledging something, and then
it's an interesting album opener, because I feel like as far as like setting a tone for the record, it does a lot for like every mood on the record, you know.
Oh well, I'm glad, because I don't know, I don't want to be too mopey. I think that's maybe either that's an insecurity I have, or I've just that just annoys me in my own listening. But you know, I think a little bit of mopiness is fine, as long as you're not like subjecting your audience to, I don't know, talking about your taxes or whatever.
That's what my solo album is about.
It's called Tax Man.
Very original title.
Yeah. The guitar solo thing too, that's trying to recreate the sound of the demo,
right?
Because I really liked that sound, but like we didn't want to just like lift it. Like we kind of kept going back, and it was like, if we liked the sound of something in the demo, we wanted to like redo it or
enhance it.
Yeah, yeah. Just yeah,
and
just
the fuzz just do it added again. That. Yeah.
I remember we tried a bunch of stuff to get that sound, and it ended up being this like poorly tracked guitar synthesizer pedal.
Right, right.
It was a line six, their like DL4 line of things, and it was like their filter one, that the purple one that has a bunch of like filters and synthesizers, and it there's this one that's just like it doesn't track guitar very well, and it only tracks it well when it's monophonic. And I was
yeah. Whenever you hit another string in that solo, it just
yeah, it just bugs out.
Yeah.
But I loved how like kind of slinky whatever sound you were using was, like the bends.
Mm.
You know, that really sounded cool to me, and I wanted something that did that. I mean, you're basically just playing the vocal melody again, but it sounds
right
so transformational. And then we did the one overdub over it.
Oh right, the flute.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I mean that really just kind of came together out of nowhere while I was flipping through patches, but it worked really well. It was also kind of a very, I guess, a private musical joke, in that my girlfriend, she keeps telling me like there should be flute on this album, and I'm like, I don't know about flute. I don't know about flute for this one. And I was like, yeah, that kind of works.
Oh, it's so funny.
Her dream has come true.
I feel like it's also kind of the loudest song on the record. Like, when the drums kick in, it always feels like this kind of, like, I mean, being that I didn't play on it, it was surprising to me how loud it was at first compared to the other stuff we tracked, you know?
Yeah.
But then, like, again, like, as sort of, like, an overture to the rest of the album, it's just interesting in the way that it, like, dynamically, I feel like it's kind of a peak in a way.
Right, no, I think I wanted to take it that direction, and like Brothers nailed the drum part, Ian Brothers. Yeah. But yeah, because the first demo of that was really quiet, and I you know, I like a slow build to begin a record, but I don't know. He added something to it where it like keeps your attention, and it starts it off with a bang, I guess.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, that one's pretty meat and potatoes.
Yeah, it's
pretty it's the song with minimal instrumentation. Played some bass on it. Oh yeah, you used that Moog pedal for the bass.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot you played it. Yeah, you were just kind of playing the part, and I was like getting a level on it in the control room, and I was like, this. I mean, you know, it's something that I could have added later, but we were at a place that had this really nice Moog phaser pedal, and it's like, you know, one that they don't really make anymore, and it's like kind of in high demand, and it's like I could have used, you know, like a plug-in or one of my phaser pedals or something, but it was like, this feels right. And we were using a shitload of Moog at that point, or at least like talking about it a lot.
Right I mean, like, and it's great because I think that was part of my attitude going into the record, is, you know, with Shakewell, it was all me, and like Skinny added some parts, and so there was a little bit of his influence in it, but I really wanted this to be a collaborative effort, and I never would have thought about doing like a Moog pedal on the bass for that tune, and it was great. It really like opens up the record with that ethos.
Yeah, the like phased bass is kind of like of a certain time.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of like anachronisms throughout the album that it's like, you know, if this is the first track, it feels right that you're going to hear this like blue, blue with a...
Right.
You know, it's sort of like otherworldly, but I mean, there are so
still
many...
Still familiar.
Yeah. There's so many phased bass tracks that you've, you know, we've all heard, but hearing that against like a real class... And what we did to the piano too, we added that chorus effect.
Oh, right.
That gave it sort of that like tinny kind of 70s like... A keyboard, like the actual board sound.
Right. And what was that tune that inspired you?
Oh yeah, it was that French.
Is that like artist. Disco track?
There's kind of a nice haziness that I noticed over a lot of the record that I like a lot too. Like,
sure. I mean, I like the way that turned out too, because I think one thing that I was worried about going in is that there's a real haziness to Shakewell too. And I think that's just from the lo-fi production of it. But we were able to take that texture and bring it to the studio.
Yeah, that piano sound was from Clara Luciani's record. I gotta find which song it is.
Yep.
Yeah. Les Chanteurs. It's like, it makes a grand piano, like it keeps like the size of a grand piano, but it kind of just makes it sound like a, I don't know, just something different, but we've also heard that, you know, like in like Elton John records and a lot of disco. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very, very unique, cause it doesn't sound electronic. It sounds like a real piano. It's just a little glitzier.
Yeah. It does sound like it has like a spotlight on it a little bit more. Yeah. And I love that it's on a grand, like that felt like there was a spotlight on the piano. And then like when the sax comes in, it's just like, yeah, it's a street light. It just seemed like there were so few elements to the song that it felt like everything needed to have its moment, you know. And adding that phase on the bass kind of helps that, you know, when it's creeping in and it's not just like hanging back and, you know, providing like a bass line, when it kind of starts plinking in, that's its little moment, you know.
Right.
I believe any opener on an album should also work as a closer, and we've got that with this song, folks. Subscribe to the podcast to learn about the rest of Good American Songbook track by track. Visit BigSecretRecords.com or find the label on Instagram and TikTok to learn more about what's next. From the label, thank you for listening.